Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Europeans might rest a bit easier tonight as EU leaders broke through a major hurdle, moving a budget deal with COVID stimulus funds a step closer to reality. In a moment, we'll hear from the Austrian Chancellor about getting relief to his own citizens before they're left out on the street. But in the United States, Americans desperate for help are looking to their leaders and not seeing much. Here are the Senate majority and minority leaders discussing COVID relief.
Compromise is within reach. We know where we agree. We can do this. Let me say it again. We can do this. And we need to do this.
For some reason, in the midst of this generational crisis, Republican leader McConnell does not seem inclined to compromise, to actually get something done.
So, amid all the politicking, what actually is going to happen for the people who need it most? We are going to talk right now to the California Congresswoman Katie Porter, who's made a name for herself as a fierce advocate for the everyday American, using her legal chops and trusty whiteboard. Porter has doggedly questioned the powerful. Many of those moments, of course, have gone viral, and she is joining me now from Irvine, California. Congresswoman Porter, I don't know, rival, viral, I must have been having some different thoughts out there, but tell me something. Are you any closer? Is there actually room for a deal, as Mitch McConnell says? Or, as is being said in Washington right now, actually there's no closer, that you're no closer to actually coming to a deal?
What's really important for people to understand is that Democrats and Republicans have a lot of agreement here. The problem is one particular Republican, Senator Mitch McConnell. And so Senate Democrats, Senate Republicans, House Republicans agree on the need to fund small business loans, on the need to support hospitals and essential workers, and get help to families who desperately need it. Senator McConnell is the sole holdout.
Can we just tell us for clarity, what is actually not on offer, but what you're trying to bring to the table? It's a big stimulus bill with COVID. Really, how much is involved here and where would it go to?
Well, Democrats and Republicans have agreed on to do about $900 billion in assistance right now. And I think it's really important that we start to refer to this as what it is, which is survival payments, disaster relief in light of what the COVID situation. This isn't stimulus in any sense that we think our economy or the American people are suddenly going to be all better. This is really about survival, about dealing with the consequences of the uncontrolled pandemic that we find ourselves in. So the sticking point here isn't the number, the dollar figure. I think everybody can agree that we can do some now and some later. The sticking point here is that Mitch McConnell is trying to pass, to change the law so that corporations could literally kill their employees and face no liability for their reckless actions.
Congresswoman, I just want to play a couple of sound bites from some of these people who are, very, very afraid of what's going to happen to them next.
The pandemic wasn't my fault. Being laid off wasn't my fault. I'm not ashamed that I have to rely on the system that I've paid into for years. It's just frustrating that it's not equipped for what we're dealing with right now.
It's just really overwhelming and scary because we don't know, what's going to happen in there. They could say we got to move out in a week and we don't know.
America is right in the middle of a food crisis. Absolutely. No question. And what I want your audience to keep in mind is for every one of those cars, there are tens of millions of people who don't make it to that line.
So what, I mean, look, you're a congresswoman, you represent people in your area, in your district. What are the worst off going to face? We heard a little bit in those sound bites, but paint a picture for us if this doesn't happen. And there's apparently only a few days, just over a week, for this congressional session.
Well, let's be clear. People have already been struggling and suffering. We have lines, hundreds of cars in food bank lines right here in Orange County. I've been loading food into cars. We should have passed a bill to help people months ago. And House Democrats put forward a bill back in July because it was needed then. And so, yes, there are some programs expiring at the end of the year, like expanded unemployment insurance, protections from evictions. It's really important that we don't allow those to expire, that we don't force people to be worried right through the Christmas holiday about losing housing, about not having money to pay for food. But COVID isn't going to go away in the next 2 weeks or in the next month or in the next 2 months. So we need to pass a bill that's big enough to actually provide help to get us through this pandemic until we can begin to have widespread, safe and effective vaccination.
Okay, so you have just called out Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. And let me just ask you to explain to us, because he's saying that there is, a way forward. He weighed in yesterday trying to break the impasse, he said, and proposes taking both state and local aid and liability protections off the table for further consideration and moving ahead on everything else. You've called this, basically corruption in real time. Why do you use that kind of word?
Well, because what he's proposing to do is to fail to meet the need of the American people. When we hear him saying, well, let's take state and local off the table, let's understand what state and local relief means. It means that workers continue to get paychecks. It means that we stave off widespread layoffs in our school system of essential public health workers, of first responders. It means that the state and local governments won't have resources to continue to fund those food banks and to provide assistance for people. The fact that he is holding up this agreement over wanting to pass a corporate, quote, liability shield, this is really a license to kill that he's trying to push forward here. He's holding up the entire package over this. He should drop this effort at trying to shield big corporations. The legal standard already is very protective of businesses. And in fact, as of today, there are more election lawsuits brought by Trump about the presidential election than there are medical malpractice or personal injury COVID lawsuits in the country. This is not a real problem that he's trying to solve. It's a giveaway to big corporations who fund his campaign.
And so on the other side of the coin, you've obviously heard people complain that, perhaps the Speaker of the House, your leader, Nancy Pelosi, may be holding to too tough a line. I mean, for instance, Congress a while ago passed something like a $3 trillion relief bill, and that's now being whittled away, and it's now what you've just described on the table is less than a trillion. Do you think in retrospect that your party should have agreed to what would have been a bigger number a while back?
Well, the problem is that Senator Mitch McConnell has been the resistant person around this, giving what his big corporate donors want from the beginning. So I really want to emphasize to people, the number, the dollar figure of relief is not the sticking point here. Everybody understands that we could do some of this now and fund some of this later. We all understand the concept of, you offer $5, someone says they want $10, you compromise on the halfway number, $7.50. This is the problem here is that he wants to protect big businesses who knowingly and recklessly endanger patients, customers, or employees. And that is immoral to allow businesses to knowingly put their workers in at risk of death and to give them liability protections from engaging in reasonable, safe practices.
So now there's another thing on offer from the executive. So you've got Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, who's come to Congress proposing a bill that even larger than the one being negotiated, but it includes state and local funding, which you want, and direct checks for American families. Is that a starter? Presumably that has the president's approval.
Secretary Mnuchin is correct to be pushing forward on state and local relief and direct help disaster relief payments to families. Again, I think stimulus is absolutely the wrong word to use here. These are checks to help people pay their rent and put food on the table and pay for necessities. So I'm heartened that that is where Secretary Mnuchin is, but the president needs to make clear, and we all need to bring pressure to bear on the Senate Republicans, particularly Mitch McConnell, that we need to pass help for American families, and we need to do it now. Frankly, we needed to do it 6 months ago, and he's been resistant and been the sticking point on this at least since this spring and summer.
And so we know also that there are different sectors which are hurt and affected differently. We know that African Americans, people of color, are having the hardest time. We also know that women, on top of all of that, are having a doubly hard time. You yourself are a single mother. You know how juggling all these everyday issues, you know how difficult it is. What is it that singles out women, that makes women take such a huge burden since the pandemic began? And is there anything that can be done or anything that's being thought about being done for women and the breadwinners, women breadwinners?
We absolutely need to make more investment in childcare, and we need to recognize the fact that women are exiting the workforce is not sort of a natural consequence. It's a consequence of policy. It's a consequence of the wage gap, the lack of gender equality in paychecks and in opportunities for women. If we had more support for working parents, then we would not find ourselves having women exiting the workforce in record numbers. And when women exit the workforce, it's not just a problem for them or for their family. It's a problem for our entire economy, because our global competitors, whether they're in Europe or Asia, are all countries that do more to support working parents than we do here in the United States. So COVID is really just highlighting the existence of longstanding problems that our country has struggled to address, like the gender pay gap.
Let me ask you, because President-elect Joe Biden has named quite a few women to the big major departments, particularly when it comes to finances and economics. Obviously, Janet Yellen, former Fed, he's nominated as Secretary of Treasury. Cecilia Rouse, head of Council of Economic Advisors. Neera Tanden as Director of the Office of Management and Budget. Obviously, there's some controversy there, according to, your politics over there. But do you think having more women, I know you just touched on this, but in the United States, having more women in positions of financial, direction will help at all?
Absolutely. Representation matters. And we see this in research in virtually every field. We know, for example, that female physicians or doctors communicate differently with patients and listen differently to their patients. We know it's true in boardrooms, that when boardrooms have gender equity, the companies are likely to take less risk and make more profit. The same thing is true in government. Gender equality doesn't just benefit women, it benefits everyone because it produces better governance. And I'm particularly excited about having Janet Yellen as Treasury Secretary. It's really a historic appointment, not only to have her perspective as a woman, but also to have her perspective as someone who's focused on labor economics, on the work that people do to contribute to our GDP.
Let me ask you how you're enduring the latest COVID lockdowns in your state. I don't know whether your area is under the regional tiers that have to do a severe lockdown, but clearly it's reared its very ugly head, and California is being hit very hard by COVID right now.
Absolutely. We are under a limited stay-at-home order, and I appreciate our governor, Governor Newsom, looking out for people and trying to direct us to protect our own health, the health of those around us, and the well-being of those medical workers. We have hospitals in this country that have zero available intensive care unit beds. And so it's really, really important that we all do what we can to try to prevent the spread of COVID. COVID. It is not under control in this country, and we are still continuing to see cases climb.
You know, I just want to do a sort of a hard turn because this administration has really, as you know, cut out so much regulation when it comes to climate, when it comes to air, water, and your state has endured so much in the, you know, the brush fires and all of that terrible, you know, damage. And obviously, your state also has been a big pioneer in trying to mitigate climate change. President-elect Biden has really made that a priority for to the point of appointing a climate czar, former Secretary of State, with a cabinet-level position. How do you think that is going to help your state? And do you think that people will start accepting the need for action on climate change?
Absolutely, I think it's going to help. And I think that no one state, no one country can solve the global phenomenon of climate change. We need allies and partnerships. We need strategic agreements. So obviously, step one is making sure that the United States returns to the Paris Accord and honors its commitment. But it's also about recognizing that the transformation from fossil fuel energy to green energy provides tremendous opportunity for economic growth, global competition, the creation of new jobs. And so this is something that we should be embracing and leaning into. If we want to win the manufacturing jobs of the next decade or next century, we need to make sure that we're able to do that manufacturing in a clean and green way.
And just finally, you've seen the administration trying their hardest to cement a lot of the deregulation and a lot of the issues around climate that they've been rolling back. How difficult will that be for the president-elect, for the next administration to reverse?
Well, I think there is going to be a lot of work for the next administration to reverse some of those policies. Some of them were passed. You know, President Trump's wrapping up his fourth year as president, so some of the harm has already been done and will be hard to reverse. But I feel very good about the people that President-elect Joe Biden is tasking with working on climate and environmental issues. And I'm excited about, you know, starting the next Congress and being able to work from my position on the Oversight Committee to hold polluters accountable.
Congresswoman Katie Porter, thank you so much for joining us from California tonight. And we've just mentioned the European Union looks set to pass a budget deal, including much-needed cash for COVID relief. But another deal, this one between Brexit Britain and the EU on trade, is looking far less likely. The time is ticking before the EU and the UK are officially finally divorced on December 31st. And if the two parties cannot strike a deal, we could see a major disruption in the flow of goods, plus huge economic costs for all sides. One of the EU countries impacted by all of this is Austria, and its Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, was the youngest leader democratically elected. And he joined me from Vienna to talk EU COVID relief, Brexit, and joining forces with French President Macron to stamp out Islamic extremism. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So we've been talking about stimulus bills in the United States, and obviously Europe has been waiting for its budget and its stimulus bill. And it appears that Poland and Hungary have now removed their objections, and this can go ahead, some 2.2 trillion euros. What do you make of where we are now in Europe for a stimulus bill, and when can we expect to hear it actually happen?
Well, I think what is positive is that we took enormous decisions on the European level in the last few months, and everything is prepared, not only the budget, but also the recovery fund. But as you mentioned, there are some debates still open with Hungary and Poland, and I hope that the German presidency will be able to find a solution. Rule of law, freedom of speech, and democracy are extremely important pillars of the EU, and these pillars should not be negotiable.
So that's really interesting. You're really putting down your marker. Those are very, very central to the EU project. What do you make of Poland and Hungary trying to use those as obstructions?
Well, we are unhappy about that, as you can imagine, and it brings us in a difficult situation. But I hope that it will be possible to find a solution and to find a compromise. It's not an easy job for the German presidency, but Angela Merkel is extremely experienced. There's a lot of pressure on Hungary and on Poland, and I hope that there will be a solution in the end.
So you mentioned Chancellor Merkel. I'm sure you yourself and all of your European fellow heads of government are very concerned about Brexit. And as you know, clearly, Prime Minister Boris Johnson is having dinner with European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. What do you think at this point? Do you think there is a deal to be made? Or, as some are saying, you know, it looks like Britain may be headed for a no-deal exit.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to mention that we are extremely unhappy that the UK decided to leave the EU. Our goal was always to avoid a no-deal scenario, to avoid a hard Brexit. And I think all responsible negotiators did an extremely good job, especially Michel Barnier, who was the chief negotiator for the European Union. There are still some open questions, but I think that Ursula von der Leyen and Boris Johnson will be able to solve these last few open issues. And I don't think that UK and Boris Johnson really want a no-deal scenario.
This is what Boris Johnson told Parliament shortly before taking off, before he goes to meet with Madame von der Leyen. He is talking about the level playing field aspect of this deal. Let's just play it.
A good deal is still there to be done, and I look forward to discussing it with Commissioner von der Leyen tonight. But I must tell the House that our friends in the EU are currently insisting that if they pass a new law in the future with which we in this country do not comply or don't follow suit, then they want the automatic right, Mr. Speaker, to punish us and to retaliate.
So, Chancellor, I wonder what you make of that. Essentially, he's saying that he doesn't want the UK to be obliged to follow future EU regulations, especially, you know, essentially what others are doing, Iceland, Norway, Switzerland. They have to accept those regulations in order to have access to the single market. Is what Boris Johnson's saying acceptable?
Well, from our point of view, that's not acceptable. As you can imagine, the level playing field is one of the open issues we still have, and I would say it's probably the most important open issue we still have. So I hope that there will be a solution in the end. I understand the wishes of UK, but I think that our position as European Union is also understandable. And as you mentioned before, the rules are the same for other countries as well, like Norway or Switzerland.
So I want to turn to a summit you're going to be having this week, I think starting tomorrow, on the issue of terrorism in your country, obviously also in France. You're joined up with President Macron to take on terrorism, extremism. And I'm trying to get to the bottom of what it is that you are proposing. From what I gather, you want to create a new criminal offence called political Islam. Can you explain to me what that means exactly and what would be the punishment for it?
Well, I think that there are many areas in the European Union where we should cooperate in the fight against terrorism and radical Islam. It is important that we fight against the structures of ISIS and other terrorist organizations. It is important that we have our borders under control as European Union, that we decide who is allowed to come to the European Union and who is not. And of course, we should also fight the idea behind the terror, the political Islam, the radical ideas. And I'm very happy that this time at the council meeting, we will have these issues on the agenda. Emmanuel Macron, Austria, some other countries made suggestions, and I hope that we will be able to make decisions on that. Besides that, of course, we also work on necessary steps in Austria. And there, I think it is important that we keep foreign terrorist fighters in custody or under electronic surveillance for longer, because all these foreign terrorist fighters who live in the European Union are ticking time bombs. And besides that, I think we have to make it impossible for different groups to mislead our youth, and we have to fight against the ideas of the political Islam.
Last month, you suffered a terrorist attack in which four members of your community were killed. A gunman opened fire, and he was then identified as an ISIS sympathizer. We saw the same situation happen in France. We saw a teacher beheaded. We saw then three people stabbed in a church, outside a church. One thing I want to ask you, though, is this. Your critics, and also President Macron's critics, are saying that this new idea that you're proposing, to an extent, it's about domestic politics as well. As you know, your Justice Department was criticized for releasing this person early, too early, it seems, and that there were warnings about the danger of this particular person which were not heeded. Talk to me about that.
Well, you're absolutely right. There are some open questions, and we have already started an internal investigation in order to find out if mistakes were made and what we can learn. We don't have the results of this investigation yet, but what is already clear for us is that we will have to strengthen our domestic intelligence agency, and that we also must become better in controlling the foreign terrorist fighters in our country. We have about 300 people who left Austria in the past to fight for ISIS in Syria and in Iraq, and many of them returned, and of course all of them are ticking time bombs. They are a threat to our society, and we will try our best to protect our people as well as possible.
So now I want to ask you about how you actually define political Islam, because as you can imagine, it's a massive spectrum. And here you have the president of the Islamic religious community in Austria. This is what he says. There is no definition of political Islam. I would like to invite all people of prudence and reason to consider that we as a society must distinguish between the peaceful religion of Islam and these extremists. So my question to you, Chancellor, is what measures do you put in place to distinguish between the peaceful practitioners and those who you rightly call out who are terrorists, and particularly what safeguards you put in place so that your Muslim community does not feel a sense of collective threat or collective punishment?
I think what you said is an extremely important point. After the terrorist attack in Vienna, it was important for me to say that this is not a fight between religious groups. This is not a fight between Christians and Muslims. It's not a fight between Austrians and migrants. It is a fight between all people who believe in our open and free societies and those who want to fight against our societies. And I can assure you that all the measures we take are not directed against the religious group, are not directed against the religion, but against extremism, which undermines our constitution. And I would say this is also the definition of political Islam. It's the idea of undermining our constitution. It's the misuse of a religion.
Can I ask you about, I don't know whether you would agree with me, but some have talked about your own political evolution, perhaps. You know, you used to be in a coalition with the Freedom Party. And we know that this was a far-right party whose first leader was, in fact, a former Nazi and an SS officer, and held, you know, pretty despicable views. Now you are in coalition with a completely different party, which is the Green Party, which is a left-wing party. Can you tell me, explain to me what's going on and where you stand between these two polar opposites?
Well, I would say that our position as a party is in the middle. We are a center-right party, and in our system, if you don't have an absolute majority, it is necessary to form coalitions. And I had to work together in a government with the Freedom Party, which worked quite well in many areas. And I now work together with the Green Party, and we also have a good cooperation in most areas. The fight against all forms of anti-Semitism has always been important for me and also for the country and our government.
You've been known to have a very tough anti-immigrant policy. You talked about controlling your borders. And actually, an MEP from the very same Green Party that you are in coalition with said a few years ago about when you closed the borders during that influx a few years ago, and when so many refugees were stuck in Greece, they said, he said, when kids are born and old people die in the mud of Idomeni, that's in Greece, that's the political work of Sebastian Kurz. And that's the, these are the guys you're going into coalition with.
Well, it is necessary to build coalitions. Otherwise, our system would not work. And I can assure you that we have a good cooperation with the Green Party, that we are doing our best in order to fight the pandemic together, and that we also try to do necessary reforms in our country. But of course, there are areas like migration where the positions are different. When it comes to the refugee crisis, I would like to also inform you that Austria is among the countries which took the most migrants in the whole European Union, together with Germany and Sweden. There is sometimes the impression that we did not take people in our country, but the truth is that with Sweden and Germany together, we took the most people among the EU member states.
I want to ask you a question about this because it's so interesting. Two German scientists, physicists of Turkish origin, have come up with the BioNTech vaccine, the first vaccine that is being injected into people's arms to save pretty much the world from this terrible pandemic. You got to love this immigration story, right?
Yes, of course. And not only Germany, but also Austria are both very diverse countries. We have more than 20% of our population who have a migration background. And in many areas, this, of course, is a success story. But when it comes to illegal migration, I think that this is a question where we have to get better as European Union with our response. It's not the fact that we are against migration, but we want to control it.
And one last question, because it's on COVID and you're imposing new restrictions. Do you think you will have your ski resorts open for this season? You remember, it was ski resorts that were big super spreaders last time around.
You are absolutely right, but I think we have to look at it in detail. Outdoor sports like skiing is not problematic itself. For the cable cars, we have COVID safety plans so that people have to keep distance and wear face masks. Very problematic are après-ski and social gatherings in bars. And that is why this will not be allowed this season. So there will be no après-ski, but skiing itself, from our point of view, will be possible.
All right. No après-ski. Everybody should take note. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And turning now to someone who's been named to the Time 100 list of the world's most influential people. He is Joe Scarborough, a former Republican congressman from Florida turned cable news star, best known as the co-host of MSNBC's Morning Joe. His latest book, Saving Freedom, takes a look back at President Truman and the historic forces that moved him to unite the Western world against Soviet communism. Here he is speaking to our Walter Isaacson about it and about the future of conservatism in the United States after Trump.
Thanks, Christiane. And Joe Scarborough, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Walter. It's an honor being here.
You know, this is the timeliest of all books, writing a book about Truman coming into power just as Biden comes into power. Why did you pick to do this book?
Well, you know, I had started to write a book about Trump, and had actually been through three or four drafts of a book on my experiences with Trump. And then I said, I can't do it. It's the message that we need to put out there is what type of leader we need right now. And I thought Harry Truman was the perfect example for so many reasons. But Truman's not just the anecdote to Donald Trump, but to everything that's happened over the past 20 years. I think politicians like myself and people that followed me, I think a lot of us in the media have failed time and again to explain to the American people why America needs to be involved in the world, why NATO is still relevant, why foreign aid is so critical, how we get back so much more than we send out whenever we're engaged in the world. And that's a lesson. Harry Truman's life, Harry Truman's career, I think teaches that lesson better than any other president in the post-war era.
Your book, Saving Freedom, really talked about the whole creation of the Atlantic Alliance. In some ways, it needs to be revived now. Do you see lessons from the way we did it the first time?
Well, I do. And I think Joe Biden is following those lessons. You start by having great men and women around you. I remember reading The Wise Men, and I remember the example that Harry Truman set and FDR set by having people like General George Marshall around them, the man who's the organizer of, you know, our, the Allies' victory in World War II. I love what your book said about Averell Harriman. There's no substitute for experience. Averell Harriman was a great ambassador to the Soviet Union because the first time he visited Russia was in 1899, when Nicholas II was czar. Now, that's some deep experience. And I look in Washington and I get tired of hearing people telling me how frustrating Washington is, how it's hard work, how the system doesn't work, how, you know, as Tom Ricks says in his new book, First Principles, Madisonian democracy, the checks and balances, the frustrations, that's not a bug, it's a feature. And that you get through that by doing what Harry Truman did. Surround yourself with the best people, take their advice most of the time, and work with people in the other party.
Truman was a man of the Senate, and he really knew how Washington worked. Is that why he ended up being more successful than people thought he would?
Definitely. I mean, look at three of the most successful presidents of the post-war era. Harry Truman on foreign policy, without a doubt. LBJ. Domestically, what he did in 64 and 65 was a revolution, a civil rights revolution. And then Ronald Reagan, you had a guy from Eureka College and Reagan. LBJ went to, I think, what was it, Southwest Texas Teachers College. And Harry Truman graduated from Spalding Commercial College in Kansas City. And yet what LBJ and Truman had in common is that they were creatures of the Senate. They knew how to gain majorities. Ronald Reagan was a conservative in California who had to deal with a liberal legislature for 8 years. And so they all understood what Bismarck said, and that is that politics is the art of the possible. Something Bill Clinton, the Democrat in a conservative state, also figured out in his 12 years as governor in Arkansas. And that's why, you know, he ran us Republicans around in circles throughout most of the 90s.
Why did compromise become such a bad word and Washington expertise become so devalued?
I don't know. I think a lot of it actually has to do with social media. I remember when the debate was raging on Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, back in 2009. I remember having Governor Rendell on stage and somebody asked, why can't we get anything done? And Rendell said, well, you know, though Joe and I have very different views about what the federal government should do when it comes to health care, I have no doubt I could go back in a room and sit down with him and we could figure out, we could hammer it out and find a middle ground that probably would end up working better than what we would have come up by ourselves. He said, but the second I walk into that room, somebody would send out an email, somebody would send out a tweet, and pretty soon my office would be overcome with angry callers telling me not to sell out to Republicans. The same thing, of course, happens on the other side, too. I am very excited, though. I think the 2020 election, there are a lot of things that concern me, like Donald Trump getting 72 million votes, 73 million votes. But the Senate's actually becoming a more moderate place. We saw sort of the hollowing out of the center. Everybody always talked about on the right wing, the Tea Party Republicans were far more conservative. But starting in 2006, Democrats became more liberal as red state Democrats like Ben Nelson started to leave. And so now I think we're going to have a pretty strong center with Joe Manchin, Mark Kelly, Kyrsten Sinema, who usually votes with Joe Manchin, Governor Hickenlooper. And then you add to that Mitt Romney and Susan Collins. And I know it'll surprise a lot of people, but watch Lindsey Graham. Lindsey can't help but get in the middle of everything. I think Lindsey's going to be a part of not only this COVID compromise, but a lot of compromises moving forward.
When Harry Truman gets called to the White House by Steve Earle, I think it was the press secretary, finds out that Franklin Roosevelt has died, it's the beginning of one of the most dangerous transitions we've ever had. Explain what he faced.
It was a far more dangerous transition than what we're going through right now. I know that's hard to believe, but Harry Truman was campaigning with Franklin Roosevelt, and Roosevelt knew he was going to die. FDR told Truman, stay off of planes. One of us has to stay alive. As Truman went into the White House for the first time, one of his friends said, you know, you're going to be president soon. He said, well, it scares the hell out of me, but yeah, I think you're probably right. FDR was having chest pains the day he was inaugurated. And yet, despite all of that, he was extraordinary. Despite the fact he was perhaps the greatest president of the 20th century, he was extraordinarily reckless. And what he knew was going to be a transition to a guy that wasn't ready to be president, despite his experience in the Senate. They only had two meetings when they got into the White House, by the time they got to the White House together. And of course, the first time he found out about the Manhattan Project, Truman was after his first cabinet meeting when Stimson took him to the side and said, hey, we've got this thing called the Manhattan Project, and read him in. And yet, Truman was able to not only respond to that information and help us win the wars in the Atlantic and the Pacific, but also, of course, face more incoming, face more crises over the next 2 or 3 years than most presidents have faced over 8 years, two terms.
In 1947, after the war had been won, Americans were basically isolationists. Abel Harriman said they just wanted to go to the movies and drink Coke. And yet Truman then has to give this important speech where he says, no, we must stay engaged in the world. Tell me about that speech and how you would give that speech to convince people today that we must stay involved in the world.
Well, I think Joe Biden's going to have to give that speech. It's going to be critical that we re-engage our allies. It's a first task he's going to have to do. We're going to have to re-engage our allies. We're going to have to figure out how to re-engage Russia in a balanced, meaningful way. And of course, the greatest challenge is going to be how we stay engaged with China. There's pressure on the left and the right for the United States to be confrontational towards China. And I understand that. We have defense issues. We obviously have deep concerns over Hong Kong, deep concerns over concentration camps. But we have to stay engaged. We have no choice. And for Truman, he knew when he was making that speech that he was going to have to pull the American people along. And he sent his people up to the hill. And they went up and they were saying, this is about Greece. And this is about Turkey. Truman all along made a speech, was clear who it was about. It was about the Soviet Union, but he never mentioned the Soviet Union's name in that speech and kept it to Greece and kept it to Turkey. One other thing, too, he was also very realistic about who we were helping in Greece and let Republicans know and let the American people know that the Greek government, they were no saints. They were right wing authoritarians who had a long way to go before they reached whatever our ideas of democracy would be. But taken on balance, it was a far better choice than having Stalin come in and support the Greek communists.
unlike Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman fully understood, came to deeply believe how important it was to stop the spread of the Soviet Union and stop the spread of communism. How could a failed haberdasher from Kansas City, Missouri, have had such a good fingertip feel for what this was all about?
That's a great mystery. I think part of it had to do with humility. FDR, again, one of the great presidents, not only of the 20th century, but this country's history, had a certain arrogance about him. And he thought that personal diplomacy could make a difference, make a significant difference. And there he was at Yalta mocking Winston Churchill behind Churchill's back to Stalin, and believed that that he could work through it with him. And Harry Truman, the first night he was in the White House and was looking through notes from Kennan and others, grew deeply concerned about the Soviet Union. And you're right, he had a great fingertip feel. And when Harriman came to him with concerns, and when Acheson came to him with concerns, he listened to them and understood. And certainly when General George Marshall shared those concerns, a man that Truman respected above all others, then went to the Soviet Union and came back and reported to Truman that if this was the right thing to do, then Truman had the courage of his convictions to move forward.
One of the most important things Truman did in my mind was integrating the armed forces and changing on race a bit. You and I are both sons of the South. We grew up watching populace in the South either play the race card or decide not to. How does Truman decide not to, and how is that important in our history?
It's extraordinary. And this is what I know, it's what you love in history. It's what I love as you read in history and you watch leaders grow. You take LBJ, who mocked Richard Nixon for being too progressive on civil rights in the 1950s, do what he did, move from where he was in 1957 to where he was in 64 and 65. It's an extraordinary growth. And it's the same thing with Harry Truman, who was the son of parents who had Confederate leanings. He was racist. Truman was racist even for his own time through his early life and into his midlife. And yet, in 1948, for him to make the most significant civil rights move since Reconstruction was an extraordinary moment. The integration of the armed forces was something that really showed Truman's growth, and also showed that he understood the sacrifice that Black Americans had made during World War II, and that the United States needed to move forward on race. And no one would have expected that. And Truman actually paid for that, of course, at the 48 convention when Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrats stormed out. So he not only was facing Henry Wallace on his left, he was now facing, he integrated the armed forces, he was now facing Strom Thurmond on his far right, and of course, Dewey on the Republican side. So he paid politically for what he did. But as always, if Harry Truman believed what he did was right, he'd fix himself a sandwich, he'd drink a glass of milk, and he'd go to bed feeling just fine.
As somebody who was once a Republican and a conservative and to some extent a populist, what is the future? How does conservatism in America regain its footing after Trump?
I don't know. I really don't care about the Republican Party, and I never did. I considered myself a small government conservative. I do care about it. It doesn't hurt me that the Republican Party has collapsed and I believe are going the way of the Whigs and deserve to go the way of the Whigs. It does hurt me that the movement of Edmund Burke and Russell Kirk and, yes, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher has sullied itself the way it has. I don't know that there is a conservative movement now. I focus a lot on what Russell Kirk wrote in The Conservative Mind, and you look at the fact that conservatism as defined by Russell Kirk and Bill Buckley was supposed to be very skeptical of ideologies and rigid approaches towards politics. And I just don't see, I don't see a conservative movement out there that's worth saving. And I was very proud to be a conservative, proud to be a Republican. But my God, I haven't been proud to be either in about 20 years. So I don't know what the future is for the Republican Party. I don't know what the future is for the conservative movement. But right now, it's not good because it looks a lot more like what's happening in Poland and Hungary than what Edmund Burke or Russell Kirk ever talked about.
What's the most important lesson from Harry Truman, his character and his conduct, that Joe Biden could learn?
I think perseverance. And it's something that Joe Biden has shown time and again. But I just think Harry Truman having the perseverance to keep moving forward, despite the fact he was constantly ridiculed, constantly mocked, constantly dismissed as a rube, as a strange little man from Missouri, as the second Missouri Compromise. Truman just kept moving forward and kept striving to be a better senator and a better vice president and a better president. And I think Joe Biden, we all know, we've all lived through what, you know, Joe Biden's campaign and how it ended in 1987. We all lived through the 2008 campaign. We all lived through the first few contests this year. We know that Joe Biden has political perseverance, and through tragedies, he has personal perseverance as well. So I think he's in a good place to succeed in many of the same ways that Harry Truman did.
Joe Scarborough, thanks so much for joining us.
All right, Walter, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate it.
And Harry Truman, we just heard, integrated the armed services. Joe Biden building on that legacy by naming a retired Army general as the first African-American Secretary of Defense. And finally tonight, my candid conversation with the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., Wilton Gregory, who Pope Francis just made the first African-American cardinal. And he had a wide-ranging discussion that we will air in full later this week. We also talked about Cardinal Gregory's childhood and what it was like for him as a boy to attend the wake for Emmett Till, the black teenager who was brutally tortured and lynched in 1955 for allegedly whistling at a white woman. I can't get my head around the fact that I'm speaking to somebody who is a very young kid, that's you, were at the funeral for Emmett Till. And I just want you to tell me about what you remember from then and how it affected you and perhaps your spiritual journey thereafter.
Christiane, I can remember that my grandmother took me to the wake. And as you and most of the viewers would remember, Emmett Till's mother insisted that it be an open casket wake so that people could see the brutality that her son had endured. And I was probably 7 or 8 years old at the time. And I went with my grandmother along with literally thousands of African-American Chicagoans to witness the awful brutality that young man had suffered. It was something that I shall never forget. We were in a long line, and obviously we just walked past the casket, and I recall seeing the awful disfigured body of that young man.
And you can watch my full interview with Cardinal Gregory later this week. That is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quip. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.